Welcome to Words Matter with Katie Barlow and Joe Lockhart.
Welcome to Words Matter. I'm Katie Barlow. Our goal is to promote objective reality. As a wise man once said, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, not their own facts. Words have power, and words have consequences. Joe and I are thrilled to be joined today by award-winning journalist and best-selling author Mark Leibovich. Mark is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, and among other books, he's the author of blockbuster bestsellers including This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital, as well as Big Game, The NFL in Dangerous Times, two must-reads or must-listens if that's how you consume your reading. Mark Leibovich, welcome to Words Matter.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mark, when you wrote This Town, only Bob Woodward, I think, gets people worked up as much in advance of the book. And you found an event that crystallized your cynical view of Washington, D.C., which is the Tim Russert funeral. You recently wrote about George Conway and Kellyanne Conway's marriage. Well, yeah. Let's wait for part two.
Yeah.
It struck me that if you were going to write a sequel, that might be the same scene. Talk as much about This Town as you think is relevant.
Sure.
But I'm really interested in, because you have this unique perspective on Washington, how you think Trump has changed it, and is that marriage like? Is that your lead?
Yeah. It's funny. I do think this way. This is sort of thinking cinemagraphically about, how one would write a book or a movie or something like that. And the Tim Russert funeral scene, which took place at the Kennedy Center, but also took place, you were, I assume, at all of them. I'm pointing to Adam here.
Yeah.
The burial, there was the wake, it was at a number of different venues. It rolled over several different days because it was NBC and because it was Tim Russert. There was all kinds of coverage attached to it. But it was also a moment where it was just a Washington moment. A giant has died. The Obamas, the Clintons, the Bushes, the McCains are all sort of assembling on the Kennedy Center to pay respects to this giant of journalism, giant of Washington, giant of the revolving door, basically, because he, very freely went from the political world to the media world. Basically, it was an end of sort of an old media franchise, the beginning of the internet as sort of a political force. And so it was a moment where I could introduce a lot of characters. If I were going to do something like that now, the Conway marriage is a great metaphor for the Trump era in that there's always been this Washington trope of, oh, he's a Democrat, she's a Republican. Isn't it cute that they wind up together? How do they stand each other? The Carville-Madeline thing is kind of the prototype of that. But George and Kellyanne Conway are this example of a Trump-era marriage, a Trump-era relationship, a Trump-era thing that just goes completely perverse from the start. You have a husband and wife seemingly very sincerely feuding over a political figure, Donald Trump. It's very ugly. There are children involved. They could be putting us all on. That's always a possibility in the Trump world. They could be looking to monetize this down the road. This lends itself to all kinds of very cynical and devious, but empathy, but just there's a lot going on
here.
Well,
take out the empathy and all of this then is right up your alley, right?
I have empathy.
You have empathy?
This. I totally have empathy. But
we'll come back to that.
We'll put this off.
Yeah.
If I were to write a book, though, about this era in Washington, a Trump era version of This Town, which I have thought about, I'll admit, the John McCain funeral, I think, would be the bigger production because it's hard to kind of write a scene around a marriage or a thing or just a spectacle that unfolds on Twitter, on TV through Trump because it's a little tired, almost on its face. But the McCain funeral is, I think, a good sort of Russert-esque moment to kind of look at old, new transitions. And it's always good to start with a funeral if you can.
But for those who either haven't read the book, which I can't believe there's many, but who weren't around, Russert was a giant in journalism and got a proper send-off.
Yeah.
But your perspective was more to show the grotesque angling and positioning. Right. A funeral where people were wearing all access badges.
Yes, like, they were.
Like, yeah. I don't have a blue badge that gets me to the Kennedy Center. I have a red badge that gets me to the burial.
Yeah.
And it was grotesque. And so McCain, that seemed more appropriate, I guess.
It was, but it was also a made-for-TV production. Everyone was there. It was bipartisan. It was also Trumpy in that he was sort of the boogeyman of the whole thing, and yet he was at the center of everything. You had Lindsey Graham, you know, getting Ivanka and Jared invited for whatever number of reasons. Also, it was very much of the times. There was kind of like a quasi-Me Too section of the National Cathedral. You had Charlie Rose coming out in public for the first time in a while. Leon
there was
Wieseltier
also the candy
there.
Passing moment. I mean, the
charming.
What? The
oh, yes.
The
yeah. George. Yes. Bush, Obama, Clinton. Coming together of the not-so-long-ago Washington. I mean, the George Herbert Walker Bush funeral was the same kind of thing. This is the club, and it's a bipartisan club, and we're still here, even though you're still there. And by the way, you're not invited, and even if you are invited to George 41's funeral, you're not really invited.
Let me hug this, and I'm going to give it to Katie. Is the club broken? Is the club disbanded forever?
I don't think so. I don't think the club is going anywhere. I think Washington is – I think the swamp is alive and well. I think it's fertile. Yes, there's a lot of hand-wringing about the reality show in the middle of everything. But you walk around Washington, people are doing very, very well. They have their gigs. They certainly have their, you know, booming economy. I mean, I don't know a lot of people who are suffering beyond, you know, very real psychic damage to the republic that you can roll your eyes at over what's going on here. Which I think is absolutely sincere and in many cases absolutely appropriate. But I think people still live here. People still want to live here. And I think people are still getting along fabulously in the circles that many people are accustomed to seeing us getting along.
So in the context of D.C. still being as swampy as it perhaps was then, and you saying maybe you've considered writing a book on the era now, I want to ask you if you think things really are different and uniquely Trumpian, and if there is something different about Trump and what mm-hmm. that is. And Jim Comey just described in a New York Times piece, he described his spin or his understanding of it this way. He said, quote, amoral leaders have a way of revealing the character of those around them. And now there are mm-hmm. many characters that we could talk about here. Jim Comey was talking about those in the Department of Justice. But I want to ask you, what is it about Trump that feels different, or is that the wrong way to go about it? And this is just same old, D.C.?
Yeah, no, it's not same old, and it doesn't just feel different. It is different. I mean, there's no question about it. And I think the only way I would do a book like this is if there could be hope embedded into it, because otherwise I would jump out the window. And not because I'm queasy over these things, but because I think it's way too easy to say, like, look, this is bad, this is amoral, this is immoral. I mean, I do think one hope that people – or one sort of hopeful sign – over these last 2.5 years that people do overlook is that it has revealed how many people who I would have thought are just probably too cynical for their own good, myself included, care a lot more than maybe we thought we did. We want to be fighting for the right things. It actually feels that it matters more. It feels like it matters more to be on the right side of – if history might be too lofty a way of looking at it. But look, I mean, I realize that the sides are pretty well drawn, and I think I know what side I'm on as a reporter, as someone who is trying to speak truth in some ways. And I think This Town might have read as a more cynical book because I don't think people had named that as easily. But I think in a sense Donald Trump, and I don't know if I give him credit for this, but I think that he seized on the cynicism for that world that I was able to write about in a way that got him elected, because I think that he seized on a lot of the disenchantment for Washington, for politics, for the fakeness of the whole thing that he was in some way seen as an antidote to.
To get a little bit lighter for a moment and to talk about This Town just a bit more, there's one thing I do have been wanting to ask you about that you describe in detail in the book, which is the White House Correspondents Association dinner, which I attended myself for the very first time last weekend. And I believe my experience is probably a bit different.
You still have that glow about you.
Right.
It might be a hangover.
Yeah, it could be either. So I'd read in This Town and have heard the stories about how Joe Lockhart and Kevin Sheekey and Lawrence O'Donnell, among others, turned Bill Bill Clinton's last correspondence dinner into a wrap party for NBC's The West Wing. And Washington was overrun by people from Hollywood at the time. And the only Russians involved were the ones at the trade mission who accepted Bloomberg Terminals as payment for renting their fabulous building for their famous after party.
That was a terrific after party space.
It was.
One of the first I attended when I was new to politics. It was like 2000, whatever it was, one, two, or maybe earlier.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. So
the dinner that I attended, there wasn't even a comedian there, much less Hollywood attendance there generally. But I want to talk about how this seminal spring event has changed this big piece of Washington's social calendar to kick off the spring, how it's changed and what that means for where we're going.
Well, I mean, I think it's perversely overdone. I think it should have ended a few years ago, personally. I mean, I always thought that Trump skipping it and not coming to pay homage to the First Amendment, I never was that offended by him. And I always thought that it would have been a good move for Bush or Obama to just skip it. Who are you going to lose? Maybe you hurt, like, the president of the White House correspondent, the board of the White House correspondents. So, I mean, it's really – no one needs his or her presence there whatsoever. I mean, look, it's a reason to celebrate ourselves at a time when most people would think that there's no reason to celebrate ourselves. I think that goes for media. That goes for politicians. That goes for the swamp. And it's just – it's a terrible look, and I don't quite know why it still exists, but it does. And I admit I got home at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday.
And you hated every moment of it and felt really good the next morning.
You know,
I'm
I felt
sure.
terrible not only the next morning but like 2 mornings after.
Well, that's because you're getting old.
Yeah.
The dinner is not particularly interesting to me.
No.
But I have found in the last couple of years it's been more relevant than it had been for a long time. It seemed before Trump to be a self-congratulatory moment and a real blurring of the lines between people who make policy and politics. And you know, for a long time I stopped going. Well, let me be honest, I stopped being invited. So I stopped going.
The Times, by the way, stopped going 10 years ago.
I
go to the dinner.
Yeah, I remember that big protest. That was remarkable. Yeah. But Trump has given some meaning to the dinner. And
I think so.
I thought, you know, Olivier Knox, who had the idea of bringing in the historian, I thought it was one of the dumbest things I'd ever heard of, as did everybody in the room.
Yeah. I mean,
that's what the conversation was.
Apparently it did well.
But it worked. And he gave a pretty powerful speech. Most of the speeches that the White House correspondents president gives, you can't hear because no one stops talking at the table.
Right.
But he actually commanded the room for 5 minutes, and it was interesting. But we were talking before, so I'm going to give a little history of this dinner. Unfortunately, I had to explain to Katie who Fawn Hall was.
She was the first.
Michael Kelly, who brought
1987,
Fawn Hall.
I believe.
I think it was 1987.
Yeah.
That's an excuse, but it's a lame excuse. You weren't born yet.
Totally.
Katie mentioned the West Wing. I have to take the blame for introducing video to the dinner, but it was for a very important reason, which was Susan Page, who was the president then, the longtime USA Today reporter, had been in touch with Aaron Sorkin and wanted to do something. The whole cast was coming, and she wanted to do a video. And Sorkin had the idea of having me in the video, and I went out and I shot it. I had my own little dressing room and trailer, and took 18 hours to do a four-minute video. I understood what actors do. I didn't actually act very well, but I understood they stand around and wait most of the time. And I came back and told my staff that the video was going to be funny because Aaron wrote it and it was very funny. And I was going to get fired if I was funnier than the president. So that's why we did the video. And I'll tell you the one backstory. My big idea was this was the first year of The Sopranos.
Mm.
And my big idea was, you know, Hillary was off running for Senate. Right. And Clinton was alone.
It was a Home Alone thing, right?
Well, but the first idea was Clinton was going to deal with his loneliness by, you know, going into a session with Dr. Melfi, Tony Soprano's psychiatrist.
You could probably have gotten her, too.
We did get her.
Oh, you did?
And
okay.
We got the executive producer of the show to agree to write it and work with us. And I woke up in the middle of one night and said, have I lost my goddamn mind? I'm going to put the president's press secretary. I'm going to put him in front of a psychiatrist?
You know?
So we ended up doing the it was actually Joel Johnson, who we all Mark and I know well, who sat in the office next to me, who basically said, we're overthinking this, Home Alone. And everyone in the room just said, of course. And then it kind of wrote itself. Increasingly got up the stakes for the next presidents, particularly Obama.
Right.
Who was a natural performer.
Who did some very good
routines. And did some really great stuff. He had some really good
As did Bush, by the way.
Yeah, Bush, yeah, surprisingly. And because I think the expectations were low with Bush. But anyway, enough about the frivolity of the dinner and whether it's good or bad. I think Katie's quote from Comey really gets at Trump changing, if not the character of the town, the character of people around them. Talk about some of the characters in this. I mean, Bill Barr, no more establishment guy in town. Rod Rosenstein, Jim Mattis, you know, and Mattis may be the worst example because he resigned in protest.
Right.
People who you thought could be counted on to do the right thing that somehow get infected by this virus.
There have been a lot of them, and virus is maybe too pejorative, at least that I could say. I mean, I think that certainly
– Let the record show the witness is nodding yes while saying he
Let the record –
Joe's become the lawyer in the room.
Yes, you know, it's fine. Whatever. I would say you're right. I mean, what's interesting is to what end too. I mean, Bill Barr has had a long – you know, by Washington standards, he's a former attorney general. He presumably doesn't need the prestige. John Kelly, I guess, is probably not going to be a White House chief of staff under any other administration. Reince Priebus, same thing. Mick Mulvaney, probably the same thing. I mean, these are sort of different categories of people who are grabbing onto a job because it's there for them, and it wouldn't be there for them if Jeb Bush were the president or if Hillary Clinton were the president, right? And then there are people like, I mean, you think Herman Cain and Stephen Moore are going to be nominated to any Fed board? Part of it is just what's available to people who would not have the opportunity to work in a White House. Kellyanne Conway is not getting hired by any Republican administration or probably has not been on any short list to run any campaigns. And yet, because of Donald Trump's magic, whatever it is he did to get himself elected and to get where he is now, there is a place for these folks. Well, the problem is that look, everything is a mix. There are going to be people who are overqualified to work in certain White Houses, believe it or not, which is kind of a remarkable thing to say. But there are people who are going to be sort of jumping at the chance. It's hard to think of people who have come out of this looking good. I mean, I think Jim Mattis might be a good example. You know, I guess we'll see what when we get a better look at the redactions. I don't know. I mean, maybe Mueller, maybe Comey. But Comey certainly paid a terrible price. Mueller has, and I would say they would probably say him anyway.
Yeah, let me push a little bit on Barr because Katie and I have been talking about this, and I think neither one of us is sure, but I think we both have a different theory.
Yeah.
But I'll give you my theory, which is people in Washington take themselves overly seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're relevant and then are not relevant any longer, you'll often do whatever you can and sell whatever part of your soul you need to sell to become relevant again. And I look at Barr, and I believe that he has a strong conviction on executive power.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have a strong conviction on executive power and not write the memo that he wrote that I think helped him get the job, but certainly not do the political maneuvering and press maneuvering that he did both with his letter then with his 90 minutes before the report came out. I'm going to tell you what's in the report, but none of you have seen it yet, which is about as overt a political act as I've ever seen an attorney general since John Mitchell.
Right.
And then finally, we find out
– possibly misleading or
– We find out last night that, you know, depending on your point of view, he misled Congress or he just flat out lied to Congress about – in characterizing Mueller's point of view. Yeah. And this will all come out. What's your take on what's going on in his head?
I would say that there's one piece of this that you didn't mention, which I think is front and center, which is just tribalism. I think a guy like Bill Barr is so steeped in driving Democrats and liberals crazy in ways that Donald Trump specifically in this administration I think has been very successful at, that he probably loves trolling the people he is trolling. People assume that because people have survived in Washington for so long on either side that they have a higher purpose. They're here for a reason. But look, Bill Barr knows as well as anyone that he plays for a team. And that team, you know, I guess has an R next to it, but it mostly has a DJT next to it. And, you know, you get caught up in what tribe you're in. And Donald Trump, I'm sure, is pounding on him to remind him of that every single day. And I think that that's more powerful than we might give credit to.
One of the things that, Mark, I've always known you to be expert at is a true trailblazer in uncovering and exposing hypocrisy. So let's talk about Lindsey Graham for a minute. you recently wrote about him. It is now an internet game to every time he talks to find him saying the opposite 20 yeah. years ago in the context of Bill Clinton. Yeah.
There was or lots of that this ago. Morning, retweeting his old tweets about yes. Donald Trump in wake of the Bill yeah. Barr.
The Donald Trump stuff, the Bill Clinton stuff as a House right. manager, right. just as a hypocrisy historian who's recently written about Graham. Talk about him for a second.
Lindsey Graham is kind of a great example, not so much of hypocrisy, but he is, I mean, there's video, there's tweets. You don't need me or anyone to sort of put this all side by side. I mean, that's all there. What was surprising to me about Lindsey Graham and talking to him and spending the time I spent with him a couple months ago was how nakedly transparent he was, just sitting up here in Washington and saying to me, you know, if you don't want to be reelected, you're in the wrong business. And just thinking that like this kind of calculated – not even calculated, just saying this is what my game is and expecting that the people who stand by him in South Carolina are not going to either see that or care was just sort of astounding to me. I mean there is a phenomena that you see in this era more so than usual, which is in this case Republicans saying one thing privately about in this case Donald Trump and then one thing publicly. Now, politicians of both parties will always have a private self and a public self. They will say things. They will not say things. They will be hypocritical. But I've never seen the gap as big as it is now. And without telling anyone what Lindsey Graham has told people privately, or at least me privately, look, he knows exactly what he is doing. And I'm not going to give him credit for honesty, but he is playing a game and he's basically telling me and telling my readers that he is playing this game. And
it sounds like you're giving him credit for dishonesty.
But being honest about it.
Exactly.
Like Washington.
It's easy to – I mean it's a bizarre couple of sentences we just said to each other.
That's
but
why
it's true.
This town is screaming for a this town too.
This town
you think
part
so?
Two.
By popular demand.
You think I think – I mean it would probably – the problem is I don't know if I could survive it just like sort of psychically because, you know, I mean what is there to – well, all right. We'll see.
I want to talk about another recent piece that you have written talking about the Never Trumpers and Bill Weld. So last week you wrote about Never Trump Republicans and their efforts to get candidates mm-hmm. like the former Massachusetts governor, Governor Weld, to challenge Trump yeah. in the Republican primaries.
In fairness, no one recruited him, I don't think. But I take your point.
Well, yeah. Johnson gave him a call and
it
was like one
he
of those
did.
Things.
Yes, it's true.
Is there evidence that a meaningful number of Never Trump Republicans exist in Iowa or New Hampshire or anywhere outside of the green rooms of Washington, D.C. and New York?
It's hard to say that there is, but there could be. Here's the thing. I think it's very easy to sort of roll your eyes at the Never Trump Republicans because many of them are media people. Many of them are consultants.
Right.
Many of them are non-politicians who profit off of politics but don't have to face voters. I think the conservative critics of Donald Trump, the Republican critics of Donald Trump, the Bill Kristols and Rick Wilsons of the world, Sarah Longwell, David Frum, you can go down the list. Most of them are media people, have been incredibly consistent. I think that they've been really kind of fun to listen to and read from a pure perspective of someone who likes an argument, likes a perspective, likes to get smarter at a time when, you know, a lot of this back and forth has been not smart at all. Like I'm not going to get smart listening to Sarah Sanders. I'm sorry, Sarah, if you're listening. And I'm not going to get smart, you know, listening to people who are very predictably going to be throwing things at Trump because I know where you find – I mean I know all the liberal arguments. I know most of the, you know, norm-based arguments to Donald Trump. So I think that's an important force because partly because they're on TV all the time. They're pretty widely read, at least within a circle of influencers that I think a lot of political activists in places like Iowa and New Hampshire do read. And look, it could go somewhere if there is the right vehicle for it. I just don't think Bill Weld is likely to be that vehicle. I think, you know, if Mitt Romney – I mean I don't think Mitt Romney would be either. But I think – look, I think the Republican Party is not as one-dimensional as Donald Trump's dominance of it right now might indicate that it is.
But given that – given that there are at least two dimensions to the Republican Party, why are we talking about Bill Weld? Why isn't Jeff Flake? Why Ben Sasse? Why John Kasich? Why?
Yeah, we might hear from them.
Let me make it a little broader.
Yeah.
Why are they silent? In Green Bay, Wisconsin, Trump got up and talked about Democrats taking swaddled babies
Amazing,
and killing
huh?
them.
Yeah.
And I
Nothing.
Don't think a single word was uttered by a Republican leader rebuking the president. What's your take on the silence?
stunning. It's been stunning. No, maybe stunning is another wrong word. It indicates I'm totally surprised. I mean, I would never have would have thought that so many people could live with themselves as they can with their silence. Now, Rick Wilson actually pointed this out to me when I talked to him a week ago. I think we do underestimate the kind of physical threat that people who speak out against Trump from within the Republican Party put themselves under. Their families get harassed just like that. I mean, and people who don't have like security details, I mean, are going to get a lot of very unpleasant shit thrown their way in many cases if you're going to be that person who takes up the mantle against, you know, Donald Trump. That's sort of a fact of practical life, and especially if you have kids, it's something that a lot of people and their spouses, you know, do have to consider. But I do think that it is amazing when you think about how short-term that thinking is. Mark Sanford, you know, did speak out. He was not going to abide Donald Trump, and he got his ass handed to him in a Republican primary in South Carolina. Person he lost to then lost in the general election, which, you know, could be a great little, you know, window into the politics of what the game the Republicans are playing right now. And I mean, that's sort of the Joe Lockhart theory as sort of evinced in the New York Times last week. So we're cross promoting all over the place.
We'll get to promoting me later.
I think the midterms have shown that there is a price to be paid for this silence. I think Joe Biden's early messaging has been nodding to this in ways that the other Democrats have not. And I think that, you know, might be pretty smart on his part or his people's part. But it does give you a window into what people are willing to live with in themselves.
I think Weld actually will overperform just because he's a character. Some of our listeners have heard me tell this story, but I want to hear it. Which is Bill Weld was nominated to be the ambassador of Mexico by Bill Clinton, which was a big bipartisan gesture. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to be his handler. And
were you press secretary at the time?
No, I was the deputy. Oh, okay. And was, you know, it just was one of my many jobs. Mm-hmm. And we went to our first interview and I gave him a list of three talking points. And I said, whatever, Governor, you do, don't say this. Mm-hmm. He led the interview with what I asked him not to do.
What was that?
I can't even remember. Okay. But there was something where he was very sensitive about Jesse Helms on some other issues.
Right.
And he just like poked Jesse in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the Madeleine Albright diplomacy was, you know, going out the window. So we went to the second day and same routine, did the same thing. Third day, I said, you know, Governor, I got a lot to do. You're not my only assignment here. You're not even my most important assignment here.
You weren't on the ambassador to Mexico.
Yeah, it's can you follow the talking points? And he sort of paused and sighed and said, well, can I tell you something? And I said, sure. And he goes, I don't want to be ambassador to Mexico.
Are you kidding?
I'm serious. He said, I'm trying to make a point about how ridiculous the Republican Party has gotten. But he basically admitted to me, like, I'm not trying to disrespect you here. I want Jesse Helms to kill my nomination to send a message. And in some ways, 20 years on, he's doing the same thing. So I think he'll outperform maybe only because there's no expectations.
You know, interestingly, he told me this story that he ran against John Kerry for Senate in 1996. And they had a very spirited, very close race.
Yeah.
John Kerry was the incumbent. Weld was the incumbent governor. And Kerry won pretty narrowly, but Weld said the other day, you know, you think if I had won that, I was going to stay in the Senate? No, I was going to turn right around and run for president as a Republican senator who knocked off John Kerry in 1997. I mean, so he basically retroactively admitted that he wasn't really running for Senate either. Yeah. He was running for president. But
so he's not really running for president now, but that's just the third act of this
play. He might be running for president. I mean, you know, it's like I wouldn't be writing about him otherwise. So, and to his credit, he gave a pretty compelling talk. He had about 100 people there. The audience seemed into him. I mean, granted, much of the audience, you know, I mean, I don't, this is not your classic, this is in New Hampshire, it was not your classic Republican crowd, but he makes a compelling anti-Trump case. There's no question about it. Talks about his experience with Jesse Helms, talks about his experience with Ed Meese because he quit the Reagan administration in protest, talks a lot about corruption, ethics. He hired Bob Mueller to be U.S. attorney in Boston in, I think, the 80s because he was the deputy to Ed Meese. So anyway, yeah, he's got an interesting history. I still don't think he's going to be, but you never know.
So I'm going to ask you, with all of your experience and context as the hypocrisy historian and looking at the evidence, as you say, we saw in the 2018 election that there's a price to be paid for the silence. What does your crystal ball say about what's going to happen in 2020?
You can't underestimate Trump, obviously. Trump has some kind of hidden vote that I think pollsters and analysts still can't really see. The resistance, such as it is certainly energized in a way that they weren't for Hillary. I don't see him growing into the job necessarily over the next year and a half. I don't think that the trend line towards him becoming like normal has really moved in any kind of direction. Someone wrote about this the other day. It might have been Chris Saliza or something. Hugh Hewitt says, oh, he'll be reelected, no question, because the economy is just like doing great and it's going to continue to do great. And, you know, and then Saliza basically said, so how come his numbers are barely over 40 and have been? And, you know, people are just dying for a reason not to vote for him. And then you sort of get into the nitty-gritty of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Pennsylvania and Michigan look pretty dicey for him right now. You know, if they nominate Biden, it's the same 10 states or so. But I don't know. I think there would – common sense would think that there would be a price to pay for this, but maybe not.
Well, we're going to finish with some football, but I've got to ask one other question first, and I've held off on asking this question because I wanted like a microphone to be recorded.
Okay. Uh-oh.
I called you the historian of hypocrisy. What I think Mark is well known for and deservedly is one of the great profilers of political figures, and he's been doing this for I read your profile of Larry Ellison 2 days after I accepted a job to work with Larry Ellison, and I knew that I should have changed my mind right there.
You did pretty soon after.
I did pretty soon after. You were right on that one. I guess my question
really
is,
know each other.
As,
I could have told you.
As particularly with this town, as the two questions. One is, how do you deal with being the skunk at the garden party and continuing to go to the garden party?
I don't go to the garden party anymore. Tammy Haddad has absolutely blacklisted
me. Not the garden party. I'm talking more broadly about, you know, being a social figure in Washington. And secondly, why do these people sit down and talk to you?
You know, the second question people have been asking for years, and when people ask me that, I will disingenuously say, because I treat them very fairly. I honor ground rules. I honor off-the-record, on-the-record things. I think people like talking to me for whatever reason. But I think as far as the skunk at the garden party thing is, I don't go out that much these days. It actually helps. I really like being a 50-something figure in Washington a lot better than I like being a 30-something figure in Washington. I mean, I was married for both periods, and now I have teenage daughters, and I kind of like being home watching whatever sporting event and non-cable news event is on, you know, TV right now. So I actually – the other thing is you just sort of realize – I mean – Washington gets very demystified very, very quickly. It's wrong to say I don't care what people think, but I mean, you sort of look at the playbook, you know, spotted thing, you know, who was at this party, who was at this going away thing. You're like, God, I wouldn't have wanted to. There's like, it's very rare that I look at some name on that list that, I would have liked to have said hello to him or her. So, look, it just ain't all that. And I don't, you know, I don't think people actively dislike me. And look, if I make people uncomfortable in their professional life because of what I do in a way that serves readers and, you know, in a way that serves storytelling or whatever it is that we do, I mean, I'm all for it.
All right, let's talk some football. You and I, in the interest of transparency to our listeners, have spent a lot of time together in the last couple of years.
It's been great. One of the better things.
So you can start by talking about how difficult my job was and how great I was at it.
You were really good at your job.
Okay, good.
That's an interesting caveat because, you know, I don't work for this.
My memory's not that good, but Mark, very upfront in his book on the NFL, wrote, there were a lot of people who helped at the NFL, and I'm going to really help their careers by not naming them here.
Right.
I will say that with a few exceptions, which we would be, you know, we're not going to talk about, but most of the people who work at the NFL, other than maybe the very top of the masthead and a few people, I really enjoyed and still, I think, have a fine relationship with the people in your department that you work. Can I mention Brian McCarthy? Love Brian McCarthy. Yeah. Brian, if you're listening, shout out to you. Yeah. Mike Signore, great guy. Yeah. I mean, no, the NFL is like, you know, it's like any other organization. But the thing about the NFL is it's owned by 32 really, really rich guys. And these are what's known as the membership, the owners. These are Joe's bosses, basically. These are the people who own NFL teams. Were Joe's bosses.
As I plan to prove over the next 5 minutes.
Oh, as I was, yes.
Get
let
ready.
Us count the ways. But I do think that one of the things that I came to pretty early in this book, is that one thing about the NFL that people don't appreciate is the power that these 32 unelected, not terribly admirable human beings with incredible power in 32 different markets or 30 different markets across the country have over our entertainment lives, you know, as football fans or as people who watch this entertainment juggernaut every week. So Joe was helpful in navigating a world of an organization, a trade organization that caters to their needs.
But you said the NFL is like any other organization, but, you know, a close reader of your book.
Well, it's not.
will come to the conclusion quickly that it's not like anything else. Just briefly, what got you interested in this beyond being like a ridiculous fanboy of the Patriots? Talk about the journey.
The journey is basically a publisher offered me a whole bunch of money and said, how'd you like to do a book about the NFL? I said, yeah, I'll figure out what it's about. No, that's not how it went down. No, I mean, I do think that football, like politics, is one of the two great spectacles of American life. It's reality TV. Only Donald Trump was allowed into one of these spectacles, but the one he really wanted, he was not allowed into. So he had to go, you know, disturb that on Joe Lockhart's watch. Look, football is something that a lot of people care about. Look at the numbers the NFL does on TV audiences. It's very, very rare in this day and age that you can get something for this many people to care about, and for such pure tribalism too. I mean, well, my view is, as someone who grew up in Massachusetts, is that the NFL railroaded Tom Brady, and if you look at the map of who feels how I feel, you will look at six perfect states like blue and, you know, maybe the rest of the country with the exception of, I think, Utah or Michigan.
Always Louisiana because they're so pissed off about the
that's right, the New Orleans
people. The bounty gate thing. They always side against
are some weird alliances there. But it's a birthright, I guess, in some ways. And I would love to be able to, like, not care that much, but I do. So I think there are a lot of people like that. And there's like 100+ million people who watch the Super Bowl every year. And, you know, a lot of them feel the same way.
So as a native Georgian, my birthright is college football. So I usually pick my NFL teams based on the number of University of Georgia players that they have. You guys drafted two guys last year, Sonny Michel and Isaiah Wynn, in the first round. So, you know, if you guys are playing somebody with one Georgia player, then I would pick
Sonny Michel.
But it depends.
Well, David Andrews is starting center.
Yeah,
and team
David
captain
Andrews,
is
you've
a
also
great
got goal. Him.
Brendan Buck, who is a longtime spokesman for Paul Ryan. And
yeah, I
that.
Know Brendan.
Yeah, Brendan, a great Georgia Bulldog fan.
Yeah.
And has great knowledge of, like, even like end of the roster Georgia players, like all across the league. So I was very impressed by that.
We tend to have a lot of pride. That's our birthright. But then
it's a good team too.
We sometimes
don't
care
sell
less.
Yourself short.
We're working on it. We're going to get there eventually. We had seven guys go in the most recent round.
Is that right?
A series of rounds. Yeah, okay. Not in the first.
Who was the
round.
Highest? Was there was not a first?
I
round.
Think it was Isaac Nauta. It might have been Mecole Hardman. But anyway.
No, Mecole, it's the guy who's replacing Tyreek Hill.
Yeah, right.
Which if Joe Lockhart were still at the league, he'd be working to, we'd be taking questions about Tyreek Hill.
Past tense, Mark.
Past tense.
But anyway, so that's my birthright. I know less about the NFL than the two at this table. But I do know, in tapping into your fandom of the Patriots, that one of those 32 owners, if not the most powerful, putting aside Jerry Jones at the Dallas Cowboys, is steeped in a bit of controversy at the moment.
What can you possibly be talking
about? Right. So what's the NFL going to do about Bob Kraft and what's going to happen with him? For our listeners that don't know, Bob Kraft
pleaded
not guilty to.
Pleaded guilty to getting a hand. Can you say hand job on your podcast? Wait, was there something else?
Well, the alleged video evidence is of.
Yeah, there was a sex, at least multiple sex acts.
By the way, me describing sex acts, also past tense. That's
not happening anymore.
Not in my rearview mirror. Okay. I don't do
all
that.
Right, that's fine. All right, fine. Do you want people to listen to your podcast or not?
Right. Get the explicit tag.
Robert,
we haven't figured that out yet.
And important context, it's in the state of Florida where anything that becomes a part of a court record is subject to the sunshine laws that could come out. So,
right. I would say that as a student of humanity and as actually a consumer of humanity, this is not a video I want to see in particular.
Right.
Agreed. But I think it would be 1,000% kind of fun if it were released just because, I don't know. I mean.
Well, you have a paperback edition coming out. You need something.
Do you have the video, Mark?
I don't have the video, but I do have a paperback edition coming out. And I also think that, look, I speak here as a soldier for transparency. How's that?
I like that.
No, I mean,
like
I don't – look, here's the thing. Robert Kraft has, I think, odd judgment. And one of the pieces of odd judgment at work here is, why is he fighting this? Why are we still talking about it? This is not something people really want to think about, except in so much as that it makes him uncomfortable, which I think I'm sure a lot of people are happy.
I'll give you a theory of why he's fighting it, because he will not get into the Hall of Fame if he pleads guilty. That's just
really?
A fact. Yeah.
You think that's at work here?
I think that there's nothing.
Is Al Davis in the Hall of Fame? That's a question.
I think so.
Not that he pleaded guilty to anything, yeah. But he's
– I mean, he sued the league, but Jerry sued the league twice, and he's in the Hall of Fame.
But he's already in. They're not going to risk
it. But this is – you know, the NFL is very
– You really think that that's one of the things – so you actually think that the Hall of Fame voters would be swayed – I don't want to diminish the seriousness of the crime. It's not a felony. Let's say that.
It's not a felony, and I'm not saying that Hall of Fame voters couldn't get past it. But I think if you're looking at motivation and what the only thing that Robert Kraft has yet to achieve in the NFL is ascending into the Hall of Fame. And I think that drives him as much as winning Super Bowls at this point. Now, that's just my opinion. He's never told me that.
Yeah.
I think most of the well-to-do, semi-famous people who got caught on this have been making it go away.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just like all the people in the college admission scandals.
Making it go away.
That one woman is, you know, making it go away.
Yeah.
My educated guess or my experienced
– Oh, you've experienced this before?
I've experienced NFL discipline before.
Oh, okay. I thought
But if it helps sell the podcast, I'm willing to fess up to almost
wow.
Quite
an admission
almost
from Joe Lockhart here. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I think that – the NFL will let this play out through the courts, let it finish, and then there'll be some sanction of some sort.
Happy ending.
Not a happy ending. Right. Boy, we're really selling at the end here.
Sorry. Mark, the New York Times personnel office has been calling. They want to talk to you when you get back to the office.
Apple Podcast is going to say the same thing. Mm.
So I think they will sanction because they do. One of the things I lived through at the NFL was a real awakening to trying to police off-field behavior.
Yeah. Right.
And as part of that effort, there is a sincere attempt to apply the same standards to the players and to league personnel. The owners are hard. Now, you know, you'll remember Jim Irsay was suspended for 6 games for being in possession of non-prescribed prescription drugs and, you know, DUI and all that. So I think there'll be some sort of sanction. There is still a lot of goodwill toward him. He's made a lot of money for a lot of owners as he was the key person on the broadcast deals, and he was the key person
in finance,
but he was the key person in the last CBA negotiation, the collective bargaining that got it over the line, which has made the owners billions of dollars. So I don't think he gets expelled from the tribe.
Right.
I think he might get teased within the tribe, but he hasn't done anything to get spells him, but I think there'll be some public sanctioning of him.
Yeah.
But
that makes sense.
What do I know?
I think I talked to another owner not long ago who said that the real crime here is how he could be so stupid as to have gotten caught in a situation like this because, let's be honest, other NFL owners have been in similar positions involving, shall we say, a transaction of this nature, but they are rich enough and at least savvy enough to do it in a setting where they would not be.
There certainly were – it is suspected that there were a couple more zeros in those transactions than perhaps.
But the finance event, the NFL, is very important, so we should be discussing
it. Yes, we should be. Any advice if I wanted to repair my relationship with Dan Snyder? Mark, do you think there's – could you broker that? Because
I could totally broker that.
That works for me and seems like a good way to say goodbye.
Or the Dallas Cowboys.
To our guest there.
Well, this was fun.
All right. Well, we could keep this going all day. Once again, he is a true artist with his pen. Read or listen to his best-selling books. Read his award-winning columns. We promise you'll thank us.
Thanks, Mark.
So much for joining us,
Thanks,
Mark.
Guys. Good to be here.
All right, Joe, for what's on your mind this week, I want to pick on what we talked about last week and the week before, Biden's presidential announcement. Now he's had a week under his belt. We have a few polls. We have some commentary, a few speeches, everything you need. How's the rollout going?
Yeah, I mean, I give the rollout a solid B+. I think he very effectively, as we talked about last week, has positioned this as him versus Trump. And that's the future of the country, depending on that decision, which very cleverly marginalizes the rest of the field. I still stand on, you know, my theory of the case that the next 3 months are critical to him. He really does have to solidify it. But the polls are really good. I mean, he's in the high 30s across three or four different polls. He's 20 points plus ahead of either Elizabeth Warren in one poll, Bernie Sanders in another poll. As I've said before, he has a way of apologizing for things that are conditional, like if you were offended, I'm sorry, when he should just make a virtue out of this. He should say, I'm sorry for the way I handled that hearing. I would have done it differently now. And one of the things about leadership is if you've been doing this long enough, you learn. And I have learned a lot, and that's why I'm equipped to be president, as opposed to people who've never been in a tough situation before. We want to elect someone who's never made a mistake. Well, maybe we elect someone who's never really done anything. So I think he's done well. I think the secondary story here is it looks like Elizabeth Warren is gaining some strength based on a strong town hall with CNN and based on the policy proposals. She stands alone as putting out detailed plans. Everybody else is a little vague and aspirational. She's saying, here's exactly what I want to do. This is exactly how I'm going to pay for it. You decide whether you like it or not. That's a risky strategy because you can poke holes in that. But it seems to be working for her. But I think the bigger story is that Sanders seems to be hemorrhaging support nationally. That doesn't necessarily mean Iowa and New Hampshire, which are important. There have been developing alternatives to Sanders that are eating in, everything from Mayor Pete Buttigieg being an aspirational person with millennials to Elizabeth Warren being more specific on being progressive to Biden showing some strength. I think at the end of the day, for me, it's always been about whether Democrats framed the race as one that was based on policy and progressivism, which helped Sanders and Warren, or based it on who can beat Trump and electability. And I think at least 1 week in, it looks like where the party is leaning towards electability, and that's very good news for Joe Biden.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess it could be a benefit of having so many of them in the race that they can do all of those things at one time at this point. They can have the Trump attacks at the same time that they can have substantive policy, and it's all attributed to the left.
Biden, he doesn't have a lot of company in the idea of framing this as,
right,
I'm running because of Trump.
Right.
And some of that is necessity. He's 76 years old. He's got to have some rationale for, at this stage of his life, why he's running. The others, some of them have been very vague and aspirational and generational and tribal. And again, Elizabeth Warren has been uber specific, and I think that appeals to some people. So you can have all of this, but if Biden can continue to convince Democrats that electability is the issue, that will definitely work to his advantage.
All right. So beyond politics and circling back to the president, he gave a speech in Green Bay last week, and he touched on a few different topics throughout the speech. And I wanted to get your take on what the president said there.
I think the Washington Post said he had 77 misstatements and misleading statements. But there was just one that really struck me, that we keep moving the line of what you can and can't do in politics, and he keeps blowing through it. And he did it again. He talked about how doctors and Democrats were allowing babies to be born, put in a swaddle, and then having a conversation of whether you killed them or not. It is so far outside of what anyone would consider normal political discourse. But what really struck me was the silence. First with Republicans. None of them believe this. And he's the leader of their party. Not a single one of them criticized him. But maybe even more shocking is the silence from the Democrats. I would have thought that this would create outrage. And I think, you know, Democrats, you know, they don't want to have a debate necessarily about abortion because they don't want to rile up his base. And there are some things that who cares what the polls say? There's, you know, this is right and wrong. And it's certainly my hope that somebody on either side of the aisle will stand up and make the case. I spent some time on Twitter, and I found that there were non-famous, anonymous RNs who were tweeting things about how it really works and getting 20,000 people retweeting it. And I think that, to me, says that hit a nerve with people, that this was wrong. And I'm disappointed in both the Republican and Democratic leadership for not making more of this, because it is wrong.
Well, I think that's it. Thanks for what's on your mind this week, and we'll be back next week.
And now, Katie's final word.
As we mentioned on this week's episode, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was a little bit different this year. One of those reasons is that they traditionally invite a comedian. Last year, Michelle Wolf headlined the event and decided to switch course this year and invite an historian for a much-needed historical lesson for many in the audience. The headliner this year was noted historian Ron Chernow, who's written biographies probably most famously for Alexander Hamilton. So this week's final word goes to Ron Chernow from the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Let it be noted that because of his anti-press record, John Adams not only lost his reelection campaign in 1800, but his Jeffersonian opponents reigned supreme for the next quarter century. Campaigns against the press don't get your face carved into the rocks of Mount Rushmore, for when you chip away at the press, you chip away at our democracy. The thing that troubles me most at the moment is the sustained assault on truth, or at least a cavalier disregard of it, both here and by autocratic regimes abroad. As John Adams said, facts are stubborn things and our wishes cannot alter them. Facts are the foot soldiers of our respective professions. They do the hard marching and should wear no ideological coloring. Without the facts, we cannot have agreement in our badly divided nation. More importantly, without the facts, we cannot have an honest disagreement. You folks should always remember you are heirs to a grand crusading tradition that dates back to Ida B. Wells exposing the horrors of lynching, Jacob Riis, the misery of Manhattan slums, Lincoln Steffens, municipal corruption, Ida Tarbell, the machinations of Standard Oil, Upton Sinclair, the scandalous meatpacking industry, Rachel Carson, the dangers of pesticides, Woodward and Bernstein exposing Watergate, and the New York Times and Washington Post publishing the Pentagon Papers. This is a glorious tradition. You folks are part of it, and we can't have politicians trampling on it with impunity.
Thank you for listening to Words Matter. Please rate and review Words Matter on Apple Podcasts and other podcast providers.